You're listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, where you get valuable information you just can't find anywhere else. To thrive in today's trying times, you need the Financial Survival Network, now more than ever. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and get your free newsletter and gift. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.
Welcome. You are watching, listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Carrie Lutz. Well, our good friend Daryl Shoon is with us now. We're going to be talking about the crumbling economy. The economy is collapsing like a high-rise condominium in Surfside, Florida. Certainly, if you're in China watching Evergrande, it's reminiscent of the 30s. I just think that people won't be jumping out of windows there because those skyscrapers in China are so badly constructed, they probably won't be able to open the windows to jump out. But certainly a lot of them wish they could, that's for sure. So, Daryl, this is like we were talking about building an economy on a foundation of sand and gravel or building it on bedrock. Well, the economic tides and sands are shifting now, and it looks like it's going to take everything in its path.
This is absolutely amazing, Gary, where we're at now, in a sense, because, you know, you and I have been watching this for a long time. We're fascinated with this. And it brings to me a remark I made in Munich when I was giving a talk at a conference on Austrian economics. And I remember I opened it up with a line. This is 10 years ago, 2011. I said, watching a train wreck is fascinating, even if you're on the train.
Yeah. You know? It's so true. And this train has left the station.
It's left the station.
Out of control. It's a runaway train. And hey, you know, and it's really hard to jump off, right? It's hard to jump off a runaway train.
We can't carry it, all right? And so whether you're in the baggage department, you know, or you stowed on or in the bar trying to slam down those last drinks or blithely unaware of it in your compartment reading your book, all right? Which is what most people are. They know something's wrong and they don't want to know because they know it's beyond their capacity or they feel it is to do anything about it. So denial has gotten them this far and they're still alive and all right. And they're hoping that it's going to...
Ignorance is bliss, right? Ignorance is bliss.
Until it isn't. Denial is a strategy until it no longer works. Okay? So now here we are in 2021. And another thing, an anniversary came up to my mind right before the conversation we're having now. And it's because of this. We are very close to the 1,000-year anniversary of paper money, all right? We're 2 years away. And I found out all this information basically through a book a good friend of mine wrote, Ralph Terry Foster, called The History of Our Currency, Fiat Money, all right? And Terry Foster is a coin dealer in Berkeley. And he got into gold and silver really early because he could arbitrage it in the days that you could. Terry's personal arbitrage was buying a coin at one shop and going to another place, another shop, and selling it for a higher price. Mm-hmm. All right. It was so personal at that time that you could do it. Well, that was a long time ago. But Terry has kept up his work in this field. And he found himself in Berkeley in, I think it was the 1960s or 50s, when he got this inspiration. And the inspiration was brilliant, because he's been watching the gold and silver and money go on for a long time. And what he arbitraged then was all these grad students needing money. I mean, grad students in a university are like the serfs on the landowner's, you know, land. And they're hoping to work out their serfdom so they'll have a tenancy, all right, to where they're able to get some money. And they pay, as always, the serfs are always lowly paid, because they are leveraging the serfs' desire to better themselves to better the landowner's tenancy. All right.
Almost worse than that, though. They're kind of like they're in a casino. They're gambling at the tables They don't even know that they're gambling. They just think that this is a healthy form of behavior and it's going to work out for them in the end. But they're really shooting crap with
their fingers. Shooting crap. Well, what you have is a series of casinos, and the education system was one of them. Well, what Terry did was he put a little notice up, all right, asking for researchers willing to work on a project of his. And so what he did, and what Terry got was world-class minds. I mean, graduate, brilliant people at UC Berkeley. And he gave them the certain task. Look up money, the history of money in all these different situations. And he came back with extraordinary data, put it together in a book, all right? And this is where I ran into the information that he put out. And the 1,000-year anniversary of paper money is coming up in 2 years, all right? 2024, all right? We're on the cusp. You don't get much closer until you're in it, all right? And, you know, I've been watching this for the last 10 years. I go, wow, we're getting closer, right? And a part of me loves the symmetry, all right, of history, you know? And the thing is, if you don't watch history, you don't need to. You don't need to know if you're a gay guy in the 80s in San Francisco knowing how the HIV virus works. You don't need to know that. You don't need to know that to be in harm's way. You don't need to understand money, credit, and debt to be in harm's way. You don't need to understand anything to be in harm's way. You know why? You're in harm's way anyway. You can choose to ignore it. You can choose to spin it, but you're still in harm's way. But given the information that I got from Terry's book, which contributed a great deal to my understanding of money and where we were at today, because he said, I mean, he's got a chapter in his book, Terry, which is phenomenal. The chat in one of the tables in his book is the decades of the yearly collapse of paper money. All right. In the first half of the 19th of the 20th century, tons, Gary, tons. Starting in 1950 to 2000, zero. What it looks like to people who want to have a more positive view on the train wreck, wow, we fixed it. What Terry pointed out was, no, we didn't fix it. It's only 50 years. We basically fixed the game so none of the pieces would fall apart during that time. We are now, what we've done is we've delayed the collapse. We have the central bankers found a way to control the game in a way that it wouldn't fall apart until it falls apart. And now we are trapped. The Chinese are trapped. The bankers are trapped. Everyone is trapped. There's only one casino. There's only one casino, and it's global. Because we now have an interconnecting, I believe that almost just like China, there's a thing to history. They were the ones that set up the game of paper money, all right? What happened was they ran out of coins. They ran out of copper. Copper was the most common coin. They ran out of copper, and some really insightful person, I can see me coming up with this idea, thinking about it. Wow, out of copper. Well, shit, it's just a fucking, let's make them out of lead, right? I mean, what the hell, you know?
Yeah.
So they started making that out of lead. Except the thing is, the lead coins were so cheaper, so much worthless than the copper, that you couldn't carry the lead that you needed to buy salt. So they started depositing them at coin shops, all right, which they had around before, which were a rudimentary form of banks. Well, so they were so heavy, they'd go and deposit their lead coins at the coin shop and get a receipt. Then you walk around. And always you could trust those receipts from Mr. Wong's coin shop or Mr. Liu's coin shop or Mr. G's coin shop. You know,
I buy coins from Mr. Wong's coin shop.
Exactly. Or what we've got now is the Evergrande coin shop.
Yeah, hey.
You know, Evergrande.
Warehouse receipts.
Where That's else?
Where money it, used to be.
It's the biggest one in town. And what happened is one of those coin shops, and I think either singly or at the same time figured out, holy smokes. I could make some more. I could spend more because I'm issuing the receipts. So Mr. Liu or Mr. G or Mr. Wong or Mr. Evergrande decided to print an extra set of receipts and using those receipts to go buy his wife. Yeah, whatever.
Well, so
that's what happened in the year 2024. Mm-hmm. The chickens came home to roost. The whole economy collapsed. The central government in Beijing sent a bunch of people down to Sichuan to find out what happened. And this is what they did. Not only did they find out what happened, the first edict the government said was this: printing of paper receipts is illegal now by coin shops. It's illegal for everyone except us.
Yeah.
All right.
Muscled in on their scam.
You got it. Now, it didn't start out as a scam. It started out as a solution to a shortage of coins. All right. It became a scam when they started printing extra things. Now, you caught it exactly, Kerry. The central government came down, figured out what was happening, and muscled in on the scam.
Good idea. We're going to take this business over. And remember, like the banks back in the old West, when they would get robbed, like the whole town would be bust.
Yes, the whole town would go up.
Yeah. Crazy.
Kerry, we're at it again. It's human nature. So now this is 1,000 years later. The Chinese once you have a scam going, it's really hard to turn the scam down. It's like sugar. Paper money is like sugar, Kerry. All right. And what you did, because you went through a personal health crisis, it took that for you to get off the sugar kick. All right. Because the shit tastes so damn good.
Yeah.
All right.
Everything's
got it. All right. And you're not dead. So how bad can this shit be? All right. So it took until 1024. To 1661, that's 700 years, all right? For the Qing dynasty to go, enough already. No more, no more, no more. Mm-hmm. They outlawed the printing of paper money in 1661 in China. At the time, there was no circulating national currency. What was circulating in China for money was silver little ingots called taels. That's all it was. In every part of China, people were had these little things and they could wham and they knew how much silver there was. The government was in it, and you had the foundation of a real economy that worked. Mm-hmm. That worked. Okay. 1661. Now let me tell you what happened because in the next 100 years, their economy started falling apart. But I'll tell you why. 30 years after the Chinese outlawed paper money, in 1694, in England, King William was heavily in debt, and William Paterson and a bunch of bankers approached the king and said, listen, we will float you a loan to pay for your debt with paper money. But he didn't tell them this. If you give us the right to issue circulating letters of credit debt. And he goes, sure, he didn't understand that. We still don't basically understand it. Yeah. All he knew is he was in debt, and these rich guys said he had a way out. Well, it did work. What he didn't expect, though, was all of a sudden alongside, the king never expected alongside coin and silver coins, there would be circulating paper money issued by the newly formed Bank of England. All right. All the king knew was he was out of debt. And what he realized, because they came along and said, listen, we'll float you another loan. And he goes, now they didn't tell him what to use it for, but the king only had one need for his loans: to go to war against his relatives in France, all right? And they did. And what happened is England was the first nation to be able to go to war on credit debt. The 18th century was England's expansion of their empire. From a little country in debt, fighting with France, they basically started taking over the world. 100 years after this, all right? They had already chewed up the whole world, all right? They got India, which was huge. It's like a little snake eating a cow, all right? And they were having trouble digesting it, but they had India, and then they decided to go after China. Now, this is history in its making. We're rich guys in England, you and I, Kerry, all right? What do we like? We've got everything. We're set in. We're embedded in the power structure. We're making money. We're wearing wigs. We're putting on perfume. We're sleeping with everybody you want to sleep with. What do you want to do? What are you going to do? You're eating everything you want to eat. And what are our needs? What we call needs now is not food. What we call our needs are now porcelain, silk, and tea, because we're rich. All right. Mm. Where does porcelain, silk, and tea come from? China.
Yes, of course.
And there we've got the British West Indies ships sitting there wanting to buy China's silk, porcelain, and tea. Now, we go and we're the most powerful country in the world, and we want to buy this. Now, China is this place that's really arrogant. All right. Like, all right. Yeah, we'll sell it to you. But, you know, and what we try and do is we try and get them to take our paper money. But the Chinese have more experience with paper money than anyone on the planet. Anyone. All right. The West thinks this paper money is great. The Chinese know this is trouble. All right. So when England told the Chinese, we'll pay you in this with their paper money, the Chinese went, I don't know what the Chinese word for it is, but it's basically fuck you. Right. And the British, who had a high need for porcelain, silk, and tea, had to pay them with silver, because that was a circulating currency in China at the time. Now, there was a tremendous amount of silver in the West at this time, because for the last 300 years, the West had looted silver out of Mexico. Mm-hmm. Spain had looted all the silver out of Mexico, built an empire with it, and now it was circulating in the West. And what England had to do, they were forced to buy the silver circulating on the open market to give it to China, to exchange it to China in return for porcelain, silk, and tea. Well, this English put up with this for around 50 years and were getting pissed off because it was depleting their treasure. So another smart guy, could have been somebody like me, who in another incarnation who figured out, hey, let's make these coins out of lead, all right, now has reincarnated in England and came up with another smart idea. Hey, listen, the Chinese love opium, and we own India, and they grow opium in India, you know? So, but that smart guy said, there's a problem here. The Chinese will have outlawed opium and won't take it. And then our buddy in the Naval Department, who was looking for a war because he wants to get a higher rank, goes, hey, I got a great idea. Let's go to war. And the two opium wars happened. Mm-hmm. They forced China to accept opium, and paper money flooded back in. And now, 250 years later, we're all on the same page. China, England, the United States, the whole world is on the same page. And
amazing.
It's amazing.
Well, remember when Marco Polo went to China, first one to visit, he was amazed. He thought that paper money was the most brilliant invention he ever saw. And then he learned about hyperinflation, and they called it flying money, because no sooner did you get it in your hands than it flew out to go buy something. And just as an anecdote, my father was in China in World War II, different provinces. And because it was so fractured because of the war, certain provinces had hyperinflation, but others didn't. So if you were a smart arbitrager, and it was specifically made illegal by the army, because it was the Army Air Corps, you could buy yuan in the hyperinflated provinces for a fraction of a cent on a dollar, and then you could sell it back for dollars in the provinces that didn't know it had hyperinflation. But that arbitrage is gone. But my favorite kind of arbitrage now, Daryl, is retail arbitrage, where you go find something really cheap in the store, and then you just put it up on eBay and you make a profit. It used to be a lot easier than it is today, but everybody's an arbitrager, right?
Don't just survive, thrive. The Financial Survival Network.
Fury Gold Mines is a Canada-focused exploration and development company committed to aggressively growing its scalable high-grade gold assets, with major drill campaigns planned across its 3.5 million ounce portfolio. Fury is led by a management team of proven explorers and developers with a track record of success in advancing and financing project development. Fury Gold Mines is well positioned to create value for investors with low-risk development growth and the potential for a new major discovery. Fury Gold Mines trades on the TSX and NYSE American under the ticker FURY. To learn more, go to furygoldmines.com. That's furygoldmines.com.
This is the Financial Survival Network, the information you need to thrive now more than ever.
Well, everybody can be. When you were telling that story, Gary, I thought of Mark Fauber, all right? And he said, there's always a bull market somewhere. And the corollary to that, there's always an arbitrage somewhere, all right? There's always an arbitrage somewhere. And this is where we are today. We are watching the disintegration of a thousand-year system. Paper money that destroyed itself in the country that it came up in China was given new life in England, and it was supercharged because it wasn't necessarily the paper money that the Chinese use, which is just, you know, printing more money. What the bankers did to it, they turned paper money from just money into a form of debt, all right, and then returned it to the Chinese. Now, the Chinese starved of wealth. I mean, here's this country, you know, Kerry, I was in China in 1976. All right. I mean, I was over there. A friend of mine who I went to college with had pushed his way into China. Extraordinary. He was a nudge. All right. I mean, Kerry, he didn't have an invitation. All right. He didn't have it. In 1973, Nixon went over there and got 50 invitations he handed out to the big boys, all right, 50 to American corporations, Boeing, McDonnell Douglas, you know, Archer Daniels Midland, you know, Procter & Gamble, those people. 50 invitations went out. Well, in 1973, 50 invitations went out and 51 people got in, all right? Herb went there, all right, to Hong Kong because he knew the doors were open, all right? And he went down to the every day, and they said, no, no, no. You know, like, he didn't have an invitation. It's clear. You don't get in. But Herb was the nudge of nudges. He really had a talent for this, all right? And so he was standing by that gate one day, and a guy from Canada, Martin Klingenberg, who I met later, and I met Martin in 1979 at the presidential invitation for Deng Xiaoping, all right? And I was there because of Herb. Martin was there on his own, and that's where he met Martin. Well, Martin's coming through the gate, and Herb chats him up and says, how do you get in? How'd you get your invitation? You know, and Martin goes, I know Mr. Liu at the First Bank of China or whatever. Herb shows up at Mr. Liu's office at the First Bank of China that afternoon. He gets in the office, and he says, what do you want? So I want to get into China. Mr. Liu or whatever his name is goes, you can't get in. They only give 50 invitations.
No can do.
No can do. Herb pestered him every day, every moment, every hour until Mr. Liu made a phone call to somebody who did something because he owed a personal favor to Mr. Liu, and Herb got an invitation. Okay? This is 1973. Okay? And so I knew her from college. And 3 years later, Herb asked me, hey, do you want to go to China? Everybody did it at that. Kerry, I said, no.
You wanted to go, but you didn't want to necessarily stay there.
No, I didn't want to go. I'm Chinese. I grew up around Chinese people. They weren't exotic. They were everybody I had known when I was growing up. And it was not something I wanted to pursue. All right. I'd finally gotten away from the family. All right. And Herb was smarter than me. Mm-hmm. He said, okay, call up Bambi, who we all met at college. I called Bambi up, told her what Herb said. She said, get the passports. All right. So that's how I ended up in China, this extraordinary place that was about to explode when credit and debt was reintroduced into it by Deng Xiaoping a few years later at that time. All right. And it's like leverage is a two-edged sword, as we all know. One of my friends, Marshall, I met him in law school, loved the idea of leverage. He saw leverage was the way, one of the secrets to making money. Well, sometimes it is. Sometimes leverage is another measure. It measures the length of the rope of the noose that's around your neck. All right. That's That's another view of leverage. And there's two, and the view of leverage going up on the upside is totally different than the view of leverage on the downside. All right. So we have had basically 300 years of positive leverage in on the world. The last 50 years, it's gotten a little wonky. All right. The last 20 years, 15 years, people like you and I have noticed the wonkiness, all right? And that's why you and I both read this morning Doug Nolan's credit bubble bulletin, because we both know that Doug is really good at filling in at connecting the dots.
Definitely. And these dots are, you talk about leverage, these dots are all red now, and the chickens are coming home to roost here. But like, Daryl, like nothing is working anymore. You know, like you can't get a microwave oven at Best Buy. The Home Depot is a little bit better because they got more buying clout. You can't find an appliance, though. You can wait around for months. You can't find half the stuff that you wanted. It just isn't around. The so-called supply chain is in
shit. Supply chain is hampered because they print so much money to keep the demand from collapsing, that they went to the other side, increased the demand so much to keep the game going, and now it screwed everything up. So, I mean, Carrie, not only do you have to wait for a microwave at Best Buy, all right, or at Target in England. I read yesterday that McDonald's in the UK has taken milkshakes off their menu.
Oh, right, because the machines are broken.
No, because of the lack of transportation.
Oh, really?
All right. Yes, because all the drivers, because of Brexit, had to leave England, and they don't have low-paid drivers to drive the crap around anymore. And the cost of height of energy is skyrocketing because wind energy, which is made up because the UK and the continent have no energy of their own. They have to import it either from Russia or from the Middle East or from the US.
The price of nat gas is skyrocketing.
Going through the roof.
600%.
600%. And they can no longer afford. And they use the natural gas to stun gun the poor chickens and cows that in the slaughterhouses.
Well, didn't they, in the U.S., we use electric. We've been ahead of the curve here for a long time. We use those electric cattle products.
Yeah, we've got energy in brain. Texas. But that's, everywhere around the world. It's seizing up. The 300-year game of credit and debt, supply and demand is seizing up, and we're in the end game. And Carrie, you and I have been talking about the end game for at least 15 years.
All right. And I will go back to right after our health issues started, and it became free money for all. And all of a sudden, the price of copper started going up. And what do the genius economists say is copper is going up because it's going to be Chinese
demand is good. Yes.
Recovery.
Yes. And I said,
no, yes. This is an inflation play, guys.
Yes.
This isn't a economic growth recovery play.
Demand increase. No, it's inflation.
And every commodity has gone up. You know, like even coffee's gone up 40%. The only thing is, if you're a chocoholic, it's only gone up by about 11%. So, you know, you can get your drug of choice there, to basically, you don't have to pay, you know, if you're getting and most candy bars don't even have chocolate anymore. They got cocoa butter that's painted brown. It's totally false.
That's right.
Got to buy the European stuff.
Well, and what they've got, though, Carrie, is they've got a chocolate-flavored petroleum-based substance in there that's injected into the bar, and it suffices for the person who's used to the chocolate bar they used to have, but they know somehow it's not quite as good.
Hey, remember when you used to go to the movies, you get Raisinets, Babe Ruth, you know, Butterfinger bars.
And those Butterfingers.
Those things were, like, made with chocolate. They were chocolate covered. Yeah. Now, this stuff that they have I can't even eat it. And my kids, like, they're young. They don't even know the difference. And then, like, when somebody does produce real chocolate, like Dove Bar, what happens? Hershey comes along, swoops down, buys them out, and now you got fake chocolate.
Fake chocolate in the Dove Bar.
Yeah, in the Dove Bar. You know,
you and know why?
Over and over.
Because the people who own Hershey are arbitraging their products in a way to make money, which means cut the quality, increase the profits, and everybody, and this big squeeze is on. You know, the Michael Burry, that story that they call The Big Short.
Sure.
What we're now into now is the big squeeze, and we're all being squeezed. All of us, including the Federal Reserve. They're being squeezed. I've always said, Kerry, everyone is trapped. When people are going, what the hell is the Fed doing? No, it was understandable what they were doing. They are not trying to stabilize the game. They're just trying to extend the game's existence. And they are given the task of keeping a dead man looking like he's living.
Yeah, Weekend at Bernie's.
Yeah, that's what it is.
So what about like a company like Tesla? What do we make of this company here? They seem to be like doing like unbelievable things that nobody ever thought anybody could do.
Yes, they are. I mean, Elon Musk is an outlier. Mm-hmm. All right. He's come along and he's basically done the impossible. All right. Now, he's done the impossible. Now, there are limits, however, to what he can do. All right. And if I was Elon Musk, and I'm not, I would think there's no limit to what I can do, because everything I've done seems to have happened against all odds. All right. And this is where I've said is one of the most dangerous things of all. When you are so right for so long, you don't know when you're wrong, because everybody has always told you you're wrong and you've proved them wrong and yourself right. All right. Now, I don't know, but I know that some of Elon Musk, all of his ideas aren't right. You're not all right all the time. All right. But he's brilliant. He is. We are entering a new age, Kerry. You and I are at the tail end of the old age. All right. There's a new age coming on. Part of it is here, and it is going to replace the age that we see that's fading, that's collapsing. You and I grew up in those condos in Miami or knew about them. I was in China. I watched those things, you know, before they were there. I've seen the explosion in China. What China's done is recapitulated what the West did in 30 years on the same bed of sand, on the same bed of sand. The Chinese used to be so paranoid about money. To them, gold was a religion.
Not now, man.
Not now.
Not now.
Not now. Paper money, leverage, debt, and credit.
Real estate.
And real estate.
They think
and real this estate. Is what it's in. It's what it's in. So now we're sitting there, and your question about Elon Musk, my feeling is this. The one thing that we're lucky, that I believe, Kerry, and you know what? To me, there's a thing that the Chinese call luck, and they're always betting against it. They're always betting. That's why they love to bet, to see how their luck is changing. Now, these words came to me in 1983. I was in Europe, and the guy, I told this person I had just met, he was an interesting character. And I told him, I said, you know what? I'm the luckiest person I know, and my life hasn't been easy. And he looked at me and he said, well, what is luck? And these words came out of my mouth. They weren't my words, Kerry. Trust me. Mm-hmm. The words were, luck is love's reflection shining on your path. I never forgot those words. All right. Now,
we have one in Hebrew. The word for luck is mazel, and that's three characters. Time, place, action.
All right. Now, you know it happens when, and the story you told me about you're getting sick from COVID and changing your lifestyle, Kerry, that's luck.
Oh, I totally agree. I feel
when that it happened. You're blessed. And I got a similar thing like that from the I Ching 20, 30 years ago. And it said, this person is so lucky that events ordinarily harmful turn out to his benefit. All right? Now, what you told me, Kerry, in the prelude to our conversation, is what happened to you and how you cleaned up your diet. You're basically eating better. You look good. You bought a new house. Everything's turned around. But it came because a crisis happened to you that is ordinarily very unfortunate for most people. Ordinarily. Okay. Now,
it killed me.
It could have killed you.
Could have killed me.
Yeah.
Not a question about it. I could have.
You could have died. You could. Yeah. You could not. We could not. We could not be here talking to each other.
Oh, absolutely. Right?
Now, absolutely. Now, what I'm saying, Kerry, is this: I want to reframe our present economic situation. All right, because I'm an optimist. I'm not an optimist in believing that our present paradigm is continued. I'm an optimist in believing that its collapse is going to free us from not only from what it has done to the world, all right? And that's what I want to say, that COVID, that the economic collapse is like the coronavirus, all right? It's doing its work, totally destructive on one level, all right? I've always talked about change as like a pendulum. And I said to many, many people, the pendulum is going to be a wrecking ball. But to others, it's going to bring a world that we can't even yet conceive. Because at the end of an era, Kerry, you can't see the new era, all right? Before the British came up with their system of leverage and credit debt, you couldn't see the wonders that it was going to bring about. And it did bring about wonders. But that era is over, and you could read the handwriting on the wall. Why you and I are aware of it is that we've got these personalities or whatever, or perceptions that caused us to take note of along with Doug Nolan.
We're outliers.
We're outliers.
Totally.
Yes.
Always totally. Proud to be an outlier.
Proud to be an outlier. But you know what, Kerry? We're lucky, because I don't know if we chose to be outliers. It was in our destiny. All right. We are lucky. And that's why we have to, that's why I'm thankful. I am truly thankful. I turned to my wife, I said, you know, we're the luckiest people I know. All right. In the midst of everything, we're the luckiest people I know. And that's what it is, because we're seeing the fact that you and I read this morning the same thing. I mean, I was waiting for you to come on reading Doug Nolan's credit bubble bulletin and to find out that you were reading it too, you know, is absolutely
Oh, he's perfect. Brilliant. I tried to get him on the show before. He's totally brilliant. He's written the history of bubbles. Have a site called The Bubble Bubble.
The Bubble, yes.
And I always went to that, like, because they're so entertaining. As long as you're not living through a bubble, it is one of the funniest stories ever.
It can be.
Right?
But Kerry, even if it's not funny, it's riveting. And that's why you responded to what I said in 2011 in Munich. At the conference on Austrian economics, that a train wreck is riveting, fascinating, even if you're on it. All right.
Well, I think we'll leave it at that, Daryl. So your website, drshoon.com, definitely must reading. That's where I found you, met you from through that, and have continued to be an avid reader of it. And hey, we're going to see a lot happen in the next couple of months, man. Like, it's just so obvious, the inflationary bubble here, which probably is going to lead to a deflationary bust. This is what happens.
This is what happens.
And the only thing really that's going to protect you is gold, but they're still keeping that illusion up that gold
is bad.
They're just keeping it up and probably accumulating it all along, gold and silver. But in the final analysis, hey, maybe cryptos too. I'm not like overly optimistic, but they might have their place in this whole.
They might have their place. Yep.
Very well might. Well, hey, anybody got a question for Daryl, shoot me an email, kl@kerrylutz.com. We'll get it answered for you. And make sure you sign up for a free newsletter on financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Daryl, always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Kerry.
Thanks for listening to Kerry Lutz's Financial Survival Network, your solution to today's trying times. For the latest, go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.